Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Beyond Rhyme, a monthly showcase of local poetry from novices to published poets in Otatahi. Welcome to Beyond Rhyme for May 2026. We hope you're relaxing on a Sunday afternoon, reading a book perhaps with this in the background, or doing some gardening or some housework, or actually resting and enjoying some sort of pastime. I have a lovely guest today. Her name is Nod Ghosh. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Alan. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. This is a monthly show that discovers poetry and flash fiction as a means of being creative so that people can enjoy themselves and expand their imagination and creativity themselves. Nod, tell us about... We were talking about it before the show. You're actually tutoring a writing group at Linwood.
I am, yes. I've been taking on as a contractor. I did a few sessions earlier in the year, and they have classes on a Saturday afternoon. And it's kind of organised on a drop-in basis. You don't have to register for the whole term, and the sessions run for 1.5 hours, and we cover all sorts of different topics. Some people specialise in poetry, other people more on the prose side. And they're a lovely group of people. It's a very creative organisation. They run art exhibitions, jewellery exhibitions, as you were describing earlier. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it and made a few friends.
You can get as many as 10 people to the group.
Yes, I think they've got 11 spaces.
11 spaces, yeah.
Book online, yeah.
And the beauty of it is that you get to write while you're there, so you can't be lazy. You've got to write, and you can work on it at home when you get back home afterwards, or you can present it verbally to the group and get feedback. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's how it works. And I don't know if all writers find this, but I find that if you have some sort of constraint on you, like you're sat in a place like a class and you can't do anything else, then it really makes you produce something. And I think it's important to get over the idea that you're striving for perfection in the first instance. Don't expect your first drafts to be perfect. Mm. Just get something out there. And I've heard it said in the context of songwriting that sometimes you need to get all the horrible things out there. And once 9 or 10 of them have come out, that's when the good one will come out. But it's blocked by all the other things until you start getting them out. So just do it.
Yeah, when I've written there on the odd occasion that I've been there, I write something down and I go, oh, I've still got an imagination. This is great. I can still play with words and be creative, you know. It's great.
Yeah, it's a really good stimulus. And also the camaraderie of having other people who are in the same situation. It really helps. It really encourages you to do the process.
And I take note that you had a publication in the North and South magazine. How did that come about? That would be pretty difficult to get into, I thought to myself anyway.
I have had some flash fiction in North and South. They used to run a short fiction competition annually, and I got placed in the top three or something a couple of times, and they published the top three stories in the magazine, which is great. So that was a very pleasant experience. You even get a prize, which I think was a pen, which I still have. So
cool.
That was good. Yeah.
Well, I'll let you describe a little bit about yourself, just what you want to disclose about your life and history writing. Yes.
Sure. I used to write when I was a teenager, all the teenage angst poetry, which I still have and I intend to resurrect one day. But I first started taking it more seriously from the crafting perspective when I attended the Hagley Writers Institute in 2012. And then I went back again for another year in 2014. And I haven't stopped since then.
That was a step up from the original Hagley Writers writing group. There's two levels, aren't
there? Yeah, that's why I went back in 2014, because you can go back and do a second year level where there's more emphasis on getting your work out and published in the first year, it's more suited for beginners and they introduce you to various topics in different areas and different genre of writing. Whereas the second year, it's more about polishing and perfecting and getting your work out and being more professional in your approach.
Did you have confidence that you're a good writer before you started the course or during the course, or did you come to get quite confident in what you were doing?
I had confidence that I enjoyed writing. I had the confidence from having experienced as a teenager the rush and the joy of getting words out onto a piece of paper, and whether it was good or not is another skill. So I guess you attend college to improve that side of things, the crafting. And when I was younger, I felt that it was cheating to change your work once you'd written it down. Whereas having attended Hagley Writers, I learned it's the opposite, that you should definitely focus on redrafting and improving your work and get it as good as you possibly can. And sometimes it helps to put something away for a few months so that you're not over familiar with it, particularly if you're writing prose and you have a clear idea of what you're trying to express, but it may not be obvious to another reader. So for that reason, there's two things you can do. You can put it away so that you detach yourself from the original ideas in your head and make sure that the what you're seeing in writing is actually conveying that. And you can also get somebody to critique your work and they will see things that aren't clear, and you can then clarify them.
I'm just wondering, how did you find sharing your writing with other people from a young age or before the course, or did you quite eager to share it with others, or you wanted to keep it personal? Or
that's a really good question, because there were very different experiences. Whenever I was 12 and I started doing it, it was like a subversive act, and it was going against all the rules of English lessons at school and breaking them. And so the poems that were written on little scraps of paper were hidden away in a locked box and nobody else was allowed to see them apart from my very closest friends.
Yes.
And certainly not my parents. And then attending Hagley Writers Institute, you're encouraged to share your work. And I didn't, as an adult, feel intimidated about other people seeing it, because I was no longer a school child. I was no longer restrained by the constraints of having to write in proper sentences and there must be a verb in every sentence and all of that sort of thing. You need to know those rules and then you have the freedom to break them, but you need to be aware of them. So that's the advantage of being an adult. You already know what the proper ways, if you like, and then you can become more experimental and break away from those in more creative ways, poetic license, if you like.
How do you find reading verbally, practically speaking? There's a bit of a void, like there's no response. It's just an open void of air, really, when you read out, because there's silence. How do you find that the first few times you did it, and then hoping for some sort of positive response at the end?
Yeah, you're quite right. When you first do it, it can be quite unnerving because you're speaking into silence. But then writing itself can be a very solitary experience. So in some ways, having an opportunity to share what you've created is quite refreshing. And generally within the writing communities that I mix in, within Otatahi Christchurch and online, people are very kind, which is great. It means that you don't go away in tears or whatever, but it also means it's not necessarily a proper critique. And for that, it's a good idea to have a critique group or whatever where people aren't scared to be honest as well. And to give proper good critique, you will include a mixture of positive feedback and more constructive comments as well. But reading in front of other people, I think it's something that you become more used to the more you do it. I guess it's like singing in public as well. At first, you could be quite intimidated, but after you've sung a few solos or whatever, you don't bat an eyelid. Yes. You just go and do it.
Well, without further ado, let's hear your first piece.
Okay, this one is called Marionette, and it's from 2019, was published in New Flash Fiction Review. You pull her up on two strings, one string, 10 strings. You make her dance her necessary steps, and then you stand her still. When she says please, you pretty her into indigo happiness, and then you drop her on the ground. Her bamboo legs unfold, her skirt splayed, displayed like an open orchid. A crowd gathers, curious, not knowing what will happen next. But you don't want them to see everything you can do to her, this other widow woman, with her spine made from bricks, her heart on stilts. She bears all the glitz and silence of an outsider, but she only goes outside when you let her. Mm. She is yours, your mother bride. Seek and hide. The crowd tosses coins. Small boys cheer, pleading for more of her catapulting dance. You pour what you can into her, even lose part of yourself in her, though you keep the best for yourself, your hammer ankles, your one loathing. Through your offerings she thrives and feeds small mammals in passing. They leave droppings, oblong turds that stick to your shoes. You pull her up on two strings, and then you stop. Your shoes clack as you walk away. When the two of you sleep, you hold her close, her hair jasmine and mildewed. You watch her sunless repose in the palm of your hand.
Yes, that's very powerful. I just read out a sentence. She bears all the glitz and silence of an outsider, but she only goes outside when you let her.
Yeah.
So the person perhaps pulling the strings is maybe not such a good person.
Yeah, there's an underlying horror, I suppose,
yes,
that he's capable, and I say he, even though it doesn't state that this is a man, he's capable probably of being very powerful and suppressing other people.
Yes.
But he can't do it. He doesn't have the opportunity. And so he takes it out on the marionette because that's the only power he holds.
Was this published anywhere?
Yes, it was in an online magazine called New Flash Fiction Review, which is a UK publication.
Okay. And how did you track that one down? Was it just through your past or...?
I have a lot of contacts through online media. So there are some groups that specialise in flash fiction. And I went to the Flash Fiction Festival in Bath in the UK in 2019. So I actually met some of the people,
yes,
that are involved in that in person. So they became real friends instead of online friends. And this one was curated by somebody called Meg Pocress, amongst others, and she was one of the people that I met over there.
Right. And what made you write this piece about a doll that can be manipulated, I suppose? Or?
Well, given that it was written 7 years ago, it's a bit hard to remember exactly what the process was, but I guess in writing a piece like this, you're wanting to examine interactions between humans, and in this case the implication is that this person, this operator, can't interact well with other people, and so he chooses to have this relationship, if you like, with the doll, with the marionette.
Do you think it's all right to have a different interpretation of a piece of writing that someone's done to what it really means?
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Particularly in flash fiction. When we're taught about how to write good flash, we're encouraged to leave gaps, to leave things unexplained, to have an underlying meaning. And the idea is that it's a partnership between the author and the reader. And the reader has a role in filling in those gaps. And it's not going to be identical to what the author thought. It's not going to be the same as what any other reader thinks. But the complete experience comes from the combination of the two.
Yes.
So it's very different from, say, mainstream commercial writing,
yes,
if you think about novels or whatever, where everything is explained and there's little left of the imagination and you're almost obliged to interpret things in one particular way. Flash fiction very much relies on a role from the reader, and that's why I don't agree whenever people say that flash fiction suits people with short attention spans, that it suits our lifestyle these ways, how we live with our phones in our hands all the time. Yes, you can read it on your phone, but often it's not going to be interpreted fully unless as a reader you're prepared to do that work and think, how do I see what's going on with these characters? And that's partly why I chose this piece, because like poetry, there is an underlying meaning sometimes.
Yes.
It's probably different from a lot of poetry in that it contains more made-up things, whereas I feel that a lot of poetry is more honest. It's more about the actual writer, whereas this has nothing to do with me as a person. It's about the character.
Yeah. What I picked up from it, it reminded me of my father. As the children grew older, they had more freedom from my father, but at the beginning it was very disciplined and very controlled. And that's my own personal pickup from this piece that you've read out.
Exactly. You're making associations with what you've experienced in your life, but drawing together themes that are in it, which is about control, and which is, to a certain extent, probably about manipulation as well. That generation that was the generation your father and my parents were, they did that out of the goodness of their hearts. They thought that was the right way to bring children up. And that's what everybody was telling them to do. So they weren't cruel people necessarily, but they definitely disciplined us a lot more than perhaps people are disciplining their children now.
Before we go to a break, I'd just like to ask you about the book that you published. Is it earlier in the year or late last year?
It was in the middle of last year.
Middle of last year.
How to Bake a Book. That was my first non-fiction book. It's actually a textbook on creative writing. And it's a textbook with a slight difference. It's not dry and just focusing purely on the craft of writing. I'm having a little bit of fun with it as well. And
yes.
So each chapter is headed with a sort of diary entry about what's happening apparently on that day in my life when apparently myself as the author is writing it. But it's done in a way that then I draw pieces of that into the topic that's covered in each chapter. So then it goes on to the more theoretical aspects of whatever you're covering, for example, character or whatever. And then each chapter finishes with an exercise.
Oh, good.
There's actually two exercises. One of them is a more obvious creative writing exercise. And then there's a something to do, which could be a recipe. It could be an activity, it could be an art and crafts thing.
Cool.
It could be how to put a quilt cover onto a quilt. So, I'm having a little play in that. And I say it's apparently written by myself, but another of the things that is revealed in the book, if you read it, is that it sort of isn't. But I'll leave that to people who want to read the book to find out for themselves.
And where can the book be found? Not.
It's published through the same people that publish some of my other books. So Beckwin Publishing is the umbrella term.
Are they in New Zealand?
No, they're Australian. Truth Serum Press publish fiction. And then they have a branch that publishes their non-fiction work as well. And that's called Every Time Press. So you can get it online through them. But if you live in Otatahi, I have copies as well that I can make available to you, and it saves you the postage, because posting from the print-on-demand services can be quite expensive at times.
And what sort of time frame was it to write, collect all the information and map out the book in the way that you wanted? That would have taken a considerable amount of time, wouldn't it?
No, I used to be more efficient in the old days. So when the person from Beckwin Publishing approached me and said, would you like to do a book on creative writing? It was initially supposed to be part of a series of three.
Yeah.
And we talked about what we wanted to cover, and I talked about my idea of having this more sort of playful approach. And I said I was busy until 2 months' time or whatever. And then I sat down and wrote it probably in about 3 months, the first draft. I used to be fast. And then it spent a long time, because this was back in 2022. It spent a long time just sitting on the back burner because he was publishing another book of mine and he had other things that were lined up. So that's why it didn't actually come out until 2025. It was originally going to be possibly in 2023, and then books 2 and 3 were going to come out in 24 and 25. But other things got in the way, so that's why it only came out last year. So it's actually quite an old book.
Yes.
But I'm getting decent feedback from it. People are finding it helpful.
Yes.
So
Did Scorpio Books take some copies?
I did have some copies in Scorpio, but they treat it as if it's a self-published book if it's from a small publisher and they're not getting it through book distributors. So they provide this really good service where you can actually take them hard copies and they will hold them for you for 6 months and then you get them back again.
We'll take a break now. Ellen's music. This one's called Call Me the Breeze by JJ Cale. And we'll be back soon. Hope you enjoy the track. We'll be back with Nod Gosh very shortly. Welcome back to Beyond Rhyme. My dear guest today is Nod Gosh, a creative writer who's been at the Hackney Writers Course and published in places like Landfall, North and South, and many other different publications around New Zealand and the world. And we'll crack right into it. We'll hear another piece of writing from her.
This is taken from the novel The Iris Tattoo. This chapter is called Gaps and Colours. My mother Lucy's colours were peach and warm blushes. Mum's aura matched the tone of her skin. She was an English rose without a blemish on her opaline face. Sometimes she would erupt and bitter alkaline purples blew out from the perfection of her features. As a child, I'd run to the folds of her A-line dress and hold onto her glassine smooth legs. I'd hope she would forgive me my sins and stop me from falling through the gaps between our stairs to my death. I only sensed my mother's dissonance later, long after I left England with its grey streets, grey pavements, grey memories and matching skies. The gaps between the steps of our two-bedroomed house in Manchester where I grew up scared the shit out of me. I'd shuffle down on my nappy-padded bum, terrified of dropping between the wooden slats into the grey nothing that lay underneath. "Don't be frightened, Hannah," Mum would say. "You can't fall through." But I could feel the tug of the void beneath, and her encouragement did little to calm me. I've been frightened of falling through gaps ever since. When you're young, you don't see colours that become you see colours that become invisible later. It's hard to see people's true shades from the monotony of middle age when you slide into indifference and incontinent thoughts about nothing. If you look at photographs of Manchester in the early 1960s, they're often in black and white. They show ominous bridges with sombre faces to match. Grey boys in short pants kicking half-inflated footballs in the alleys behind terraced houses. In reality, an anarchic display of colours imbued my childhood world. It was in the people. It was under their skin. My father, Cornelius Wilson, had the warmth of autumnal leaves about him. Red, amber, insane lime. It's harder to describe his vibrancy, because I rarely saw him beyond the age of 10. He was banished for betraying my mother. My father didn't match his literal colour. He had burnt umber skin and teak eyes. He didn't take after his red-headed Scottish father. He was as dark as his Trinidadian mother, my mawmaw. My grandmother was made from deep cerise and bursts of peacock blue. There was a restful green of the ocean to mawmaw too. Yet the folds of her skin on her face were made from chocolate. She could sustain and soothe me as effectively as any confectionery.
It's a great descriptive piece, and I really love this paragraph. Sometimes she would erupt and bitter alkaline purples blew out from the perfection of her features. As a child, I'd rush to the folds of her A-line dress and hold on to her glistening, smooth legs. I'd hope she would forgive me my sins and stop me from falling through the gaps between our stairs to my death. It just creates a picture. I can just picture my sisters doing that for real.
Yeah, and I think it's supposed to convey how a child sees their parent almost as a universal god. They have all the power, and you crave approval, you crave love from them, and you are comforted by them, but you're also terrified by them because their job is to bring you up and discipline you. And without spelling that out in exactly what mother is doing in this, I've tried to reflect that in terms of Hannah's response and Hannah's emotions.
I can just picture myself being under 10 years of age going, please, Mum, and holding on to her. You've made a very good picture.
And the skirt is almost like this protective layer, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So you're right in a way that looks like it's quite straightforward, but you're actually creating many pictures of different underlying messages and themes.
Yeah, and although this is taken from a novel, I guess because I have specialised in writing flash fiction, my tutor at Hagley Writers was an expert in flash fiction, and so she encouraged us to write it. And that's why I strive to try and have some sort of underlying meaning inside my stories, and sometimes the emotion is hidden beneath the actions.
I quite like the couple of short sentences, red, amber, insane, lime. You're creating the father's warmth.
Yeah, and that's another example of what we were talking about earlier, where if you wrote that as a school child, say at the age of 9 or whatever, you'd get told off because those aren't complete sentences. But now, as adults, we know that, and we know we can break that, and we can have the abruptness of the single-word sentence, which isn't really a sentence, but it's a stylistic device.
Do you think poetry has brought that about?
I think there's certainly a relationship to poetry, yeah.
Yeah.
And although I don't regard myself as a proficient poet, people have told me that a lot of my writing is very poetic.
Yes. I would get told off at primary school if I wrote red, amber, insane lime, but to me it makes a lot of sense because I've written some poetry and it just seems normal to me, that use of words.
Context is everything, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were writing an instruction manual for a science object or whatever, you'd write in a different way. If you were writing a supermarket sign, you'd write in a different way. Titles are different from content. There's all sorts of different rules for writing, and context is everything.
And the grey boys in short pants kicking half inflated footballs, that's, I don't mean to relate it to myself, but it's your upbringing, but we always had flat footballs.
They were never blown up. There probably
fall.
Wasn't even a pump in the house, or if there was, there wasn't the attachment. And you get this brand new shiny football, and then within a year it was like this half-inflated thing, but you still used the damn thing, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, so
are you happy to share another piece with us?
Sure, yeah. We'll do Misty next. This was published in Spelt Journal in 2018 in the UK. Mama said I couldn't take all my toys, said I wouldn't need them where we were going. And I didn't pack any clothes, didn't get no time. We stopped at Grandma's for a bit, but we left almost as soon as we got there. We got hot dogs, though. I had fries with mine and mustard. Mama never got one for herself, and that made me sad. How she always does things for us, but not for herself. Mm. When we got going again, Red was shouting like the world was on fire. Faster, Mom! Go faster! So she did. There was a smell in the car that wasn't there before, like something hot and blistered. I got scared. I'm going to play you each a song, a special song, Mama said. And the whine of the gas pedal screamed big and loud. The Chevy veered in and out of the fast lane as she twisted dials and pressed buttons. Red got his song first. He sang along with the words he knew. A handsome man. He laughed like a hyena at the chorus like he always did. Mom went a little faster. I thought she might get a ticket, but there weren't that many cars on the highway by then. A little slip of moon climbed in the corner of the candy pink sky, but the air blowing through my window was hot and steamy. Callie starts to cry when her song comes on. Where are we going, Mom? She moans over the words and music. Listen to your song, honey, Mama says. I feel like crying along with my sister. My dress is caught in the car door, and Mama won't stop so I can let it out. I've left my bag at Grandma's, and it's got all my makeup in it and my trading cards. My dress is stuck. I can't move, I say. Are we going to see Daddy? Red asks. Callie asks Mama where we're going. She says something pretty about unicorns, but I don't believe her. Your turn now, Misty, Mama says, and I think I hear a catch in her voice, like she's trying not to cry. But then my song comes on, and the tangle inside my chest loosens a bit. It's something like Grandma used to play Mama when she was little. Whenever I hear it, I feel light, like marshmallow. Much in love. My song makes me think of sherbet and icing sugar. It makes me think of being in love, even though I never have been. It makes me feel like there's little bits of God even in forgotten corners. And though I didn't think the Chevy could go any faster, somehow it does. It's flying.
You have a very vivid recollection of your younger years, I think. Was it
even though, something that you've made even up? Though this is totally made up,
yes.
I think you always draw on things you've experienced. I mean, if you were a being like AI or whatever that had never experienced childhood, that had never experienced being in a car, you're going to have to steal it from somewhere. And that's what we do. We steal from our own lives to populate the lives of our characters. And that's where details come in handy. And you can steal it from other places as a writer yourself as well. For example, if you're writing about locations, it's helpful to write about places where you've already been. Even better if you've kept a travel diary and can refer to that. But we can actually go on maps and zoom in and visit places. You can't capture the smells and the sounds necessarily, although you can watch videos for sounds. But you can get a pretty close approximation and steal from those places too. And I definitely steal from my childhood to write about child characters.
Just small phrases like candy pink sky, it really, to me, it touches my imagination.
Yeah, we're getting more and more of those wild skies these days, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, here we go. The Chevy veered in and out of the fast lane as she twisted pedal screen big and loud. And then at the end, Chevy is flying. So it's sort of, it's a good ending.
Yeah, but I hope there's some ominous undertones in there as well. Like, why is Mum driving so fast? Why is she sad? What's going on? So it's actually used in one of my books, a novella in Flash called Filthy Sucre. And in that, we've actually changed it. We've set it somewhere else. Here, this is set in the States, but we've made it into an English story in that, just to fit in with the other stories that it appears with. And because something awful happens to the characters later on, I think that it needed to draw on that underlying tension and threat of something bad about to happen.
We may have touched on it the last time we interviewed you. How do you see the role of AI in creative writing? I thought I'd ask this challenging question to you. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Right. Most writers will say, I hate it, I despise it, it should be banned. Problem is, we're not going to be able to ban it. And people that are teaching at the moment, whatever the subject is that I've come across, they're saying suddenly a few years ago they noticed that the quality of the submissions and the homework that their students were doing massively improved. And it's because they're using ChatGPT. It's going to be a disaster for bringing people into the working life, expecting them to know anything, because they're not. They're just going to do their homework from ChatGPT. I think it's totally wrong that AI creative writing is stealing work from actual authors, but it's the only way that they can do it because they don't have experiences themselves. But the reason I said that I'm not going to damn AI altogether is it was designed for a purpose. It was designed to be useful. AI has wonderful applications. It just isn't suitable for creating books. And it makes me so mad whenever the idiots on YouTube put up things about how you can write a book in 48 hours or whatever and make lots of money. And that's all they're interested in. They want to make money. Well, if they'd get off their lazy asses and just go and write something and train themselves, then they could possibly ultimately one day make some money, although it's unlikely because creative writers don't make a lot of money, but they just want to use it as a tool to steal other people's work, and that is abhorrent.
I think AI lacks emotion too. It's very placid, it's very stale.
I haven't read much of it, but yeah, I imagine that the potential there is for it to become very samey, depending on what it's trained on.
It's got a computer feel to it. It's sort of like robots, little robot words, so...
Have you read a lot of it?
No, well, in all honesty, somebody gave me a program where you could write in your poem and it would come out with a song, with the poems,
sure.
And yeah. I played around with that, but then I thought, well, with all the writing I've done, I want to keep it honest and true, so...
Yeah, you want it to be from you.
From me, and it would be different from AI's interpretation as it stands today.
I think the only application I can think of in creative writing is if, for example, you're doing a treatment for a film or a television programme or whatever, and you might use AI to tidy up your writing or whatever, because then it's the ideas that are paramount or whatever. But I can't see any point in using it for anything else. What is the point of using it in poetry? I would imagine it would be a very hollow experience, but I understand that out of curiosity we would want to try it. I haven't done yet, but maybe I will after you've said this.
Another small aspect is subject. We used to have the Roget's Thesaurus, but now AI can do the same thing. It sort of tell you a list of words or subjects or items that are similar to the word that you put in. So,
well, I use online thesauruses, but one thing that I will remember from my course at Hagley Writers is that we were often warned not to use thesaurus words, and they didn't mean that literally, that you should never use a thesaurus. What they meant was if you jump into a thesaurus and you have all the similes or whatever that are potentially listed according to what the publication is, not all of them will be suitable. Not all of them, as a natural speaker of the language, are what you would use. And it gives your work sometimes a very artificial feel. Makes your work possibly harder to read. A lot of people don't like going and having to look up words when they're reading. And if you're going to forcibly put in something obscure, then you might be expanding a person's vocabulary, but it's not necessarily going to lead to enjoyable reading.
Back when my imagination was really sharp and active, I used to just write a poem just like that.
Yeah.
And now I give it some thought. It's probably because I'm a bit older, but the imagination has slowed to some extent, but the content is still worthwhile.
Yeah.
It's still, I don't know how your creative mind works, but...
I like both of those approaches. I think there's always room for a quick first draft. There's always room for free writing. It's one of the topics that I covered whenever I was teaching at the Linwood Arts, that free writing can liberate you. But also, if you're then going to take that to its best form, it's really important to take a more considered approach. But what you said was more about taking the slower approach for the ideas to come out. And that's important too, because sometimes when we're faced with a blank piece of paper, we don't know what we're going to write. But at other times, we have a pretty good idea of what emotions we want to deal with, what experiences. And I think that's a good thing, that you can then go and do some background reading as well if you want to expand on what you're writing.
Well, that's what I've noticed about authors is that they do a lot of research, some people, an incredible amount of research into creating characters and landscapes and things like that. It's always, it's really good.
Yeah, and we have libraries, we have online tools, and we're so lucky, aren't we, compared to people from previous generations. For example, writing on a laptop, the fact that you can have spell check, the fact that if you want to change a character's name, you just use the control find option, and it's there, it's done instantly for you. We are very fortunate. So in some ways, people would describe that in the past, they would have referred to that as a form of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
It's not in the sense of AI that we were talking about, but these are useful tools and there's no shame in making use of them.
And just backtracking a bit, your latest piece that you read, I don't think there's any way that AI could reproduce that or enhance what you've written, because it's just not that clever at the moment. It's just not that dynamic.
The few that I have read, I think somebody put in a very specific request that they wanted it to be, the piece to be written in a surrealist style. They wanted it to mimic certain writers or whatever. And I found it quite entertaining, but I don't know what I would be comparing it with, because like, if I had that side by side with something that was written by the authors that it drew on, then you would see a difference, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you
would. In some ways, because the AI is more polished in terms of how it puts sentences together, it might be better in some respects, but that doesn't take away from the dishonesty of it. That doesn't take away from the fact that it's stealing.
Yes. We'll take another break now, and I thought we'd have Miss Serijevo. It's about Yugoslavia during the Civil War, and they held a beauty pageant down in the bunkers while Mortifier was still going, and it's with Brian Eno, U2 and Pavarotti, and we'll listen to that now, and we'll be back soon for some more pieces of writing from Nod.
Is she comes, ooh, she comes, Surya in her crown.
Welcome back to Beyond Rhyme, a monthly show on Plains Media about poetry, writing and short fiction to improve your creative minds and imagination so you can write yourself. And we have a wonderful guest today, Nod Ghosh, who's going to give us another piece, Bread and Pudding.
Thank you, Alan. Bread Pudding was published in UK's Flash Flood Journal in 2019. You need 6 slices of day-old bread and the constitution of a shark from our bread pudding. My grandmother taught me to cook. She was terrible at it, and not a very good grandmother either. But she was the best I had. Use 1/2 cup of raisins if you have them. My parents were heroin addicts, though as a kid I thought everyone was like them. Use an 8-inch square pan for the pudding. My father's hair coiled down to the middle of his back. He smelled of wet newspaper. Preheat the oven to 175 degrees centigrade. My mother had panda eyes and sores on her arms. I used free-range eggs, but grandmother used whatever she could afford. They'd leave me for hours with nothing but a pack of cereal. People came round and locked themselves in the toilet. I never knew who they were. My parents may be pissing the shower. Take 3/4 cup of sugar. I use white because I hate brown. I learnt to read off cereal packets. If you melt butter in the microwave, make sure you use a cover. Grandmother used a saucepan. It didn't spit as much, but it took longer. She often did things the hard way. I couldn't sleep for the sound of my parents fucking in the next bed. After my mother died, I still couldn't sleep for the sound of fucking in our house. You need 2 cups of milk. Full cream is best. They came for me one night. My grandmother said she'd have me, so I didn't have to go away. She never had cinnamon or vanilla, but she told me they were in the recipe. My grandmother said she would have put them in if she'd had any. And I always believed her.
You're very clever. How did you know that it says I learnt to read off cereal packets? Well, that's what young kids used to do. Tell us about that. How did you come about that idea?
That's a distinct memory of breakfast time. We would have cereal and the cereal packets would be there in front of us. Okay, you didn't learn totally how to read, but you've read the captions and what was on them again and again and again. And it probably did improve your proficiency in reading.
I'm sure.
You did that because you were bored. You didn't have anything else to do and the cereal packet was there, so you just read it. And sometimes they'd have little games on there or whatever.
My father's hair curled down to the middle of his back. He smelled of wet newspaper. The descriptive elements that you have are very clever, I think.
Thank you. Relies quite strongly on imagination.
I'd love to hear, just with the time what we've got left, you have a poem. The Lake.
The Lake. This was quite an old one from 2017. It was published in London Grip. He intends to drive into the lake's watery depths. Nocturnal creatures and the desolation of fallen leaves, his only company. He waits. He has considered pools of petroleum and the oiliness of blood, a threat to fish that will surround his sinking station wagon. He has thought of the rush of water into lungs, the hush of tyres into mud, the anxiety of waterfowl who expect fallen branches or the flick of a rat's tail, and will instead see metal slip through liquid and the dark light of his face.
That's so powerful. There's no way I could write like this at this stage of what I do, but it's just so, it just brings up all these thoughts. Every word brings up a different thought. I think it's very clever.
Thank you. It's supposed to reflect total despair of somebody that just can't take any more. Mm. And there's a combination of things that I've drawn on here. It was written a long time ago, but the image that I draw on is of a child I saw falling into a lake in Roundhay Park in Leeds many years ago, and the father pulling the child out and imagining what it was like in the murky depths of the water. I also used to work in neurophysiology when I was living in England, and the neurophysiology department where I worked was next to one of the wards for mental illness. And so sometimes you'd go in there and to collect patients or whatever, and seeing some of the, you could feel the despair, you could almost taste it on your tongue of the people that were there. Some of them were medicated and some of them would be screaming, and just putting yourself into their heads and imagining what it must be like to have, hopefully they're getting help where they were, but to have got to the stage where they needed that degree of help, and imagining what the despair is like when you just want things to end, where no life is better than any life. And that's what I've drawn on for the emotions in this poem.
There's one piece I really like. In the desolation of fallen leaves, his only company. It really creates quite a dark, suffering sort of picture to me. Yeah,
and I haven't really given you much about this character's life, but I want the fact that there's loneliness there to come out. And the loneliness could be because he's literally on his own and not having much human interaction, or sometimes you can be surrounded by lots of people and you can still feel very, very lonely because your connections are not there.
Mm. As I said at the start, every word seems to bring up a different idea or movement or creative sort of thought. It's very, very, very good.
Thank you.
So where to from here with your writing, and can you pass on any inspirations to budding writers out there in Christchurch?
Yeah, one of the things I would say very strongly, don't wait for inspiration. Just do it. Just write. It's like I said earlier, get those 9 pieces of bad writing out and the 10th one might be good. It might be the 15th one, it might be the 100th one, it might be the 2nd one, you might be lucky. And being good is a subjective thing as well, but if it brings you pleasure, then that is what it's for. And that goes for all different sorts of creativity as well.
I love that. It's subjective to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't heard that before. I put poetry on Facebook and not everybody likes everything that I do, but I still carry on doing it because a different person gets something out of it every time, out of all the people that are there.
And that's a really important point, and I found this whenever I've been judging, for example, flash fiction competitions or whatever. I've got to be really careful that I'm judging the writing on its merits, on its crafting, on the skill, rather than purely the ideas, because sometimes I'll come across something that really resonates strongly with me because I've had that experience. It may not be as good as the one I read after that.
Yes.
But I will hold that higher in the hierarchy because of my experience and my enjoyment and my subjective enjoyment and pleasure from it. But when you're trying to assess things on merit, then you then have to go back and ask yourself honestly, am I just responding to my own personal response here, or am I judging this on its own merits?
Yes.
But if you're reading for joy, who cares?
Who cares? Yes.
If you're reading something and you're not judging a competition, it's all about finding those connections.
Yes. Yeah. And where does your writing go from here?
At the moment, I'm writing a flash novel. So it's like a novella in flash, but it's longer. And I'm trying to do a bit more research about what the different genres mean and what the rules and limitations of them are. And my conclusion is there are no rules. It's what you want to write. And that may not help me in terms of when I'm trying to get it published and presenting it to people, because what do you call it? But one of the unusual things about this is it's one of the slowest books I've written so far, and I'm still only at about 60,000 words, and I've been writing it for nearly 2 years now, which is very unusual for me.
And how do you react to that?
Slowed down. Sometimes I think, well, get on with it. And then other times I think, well, does it matter? Like, if you're enjoying writing it, then just do it.
A novelette is what you called it?
It's a flash novel.
Flash novel.
So it's similar to a novella in flash, but it's longer. Carry on. Yeah.
Does it worry you if you write a passage and then you think, oh, this is no good, and put it in the rubbish bin pretty much? Do you have much of that?
It happens all the time. In fact, in the book, How to Bake a Book, I say, don't be scared of throwing things away, because the redrafting process is all important. But I never literally throw them away. I write on my laptop, and what I do is I have a recycling bin.
Ah, yes.
And so those things go in there. And that helps because it doesn't feel like you've wasted your time, and it makes you more amenable to getting something out of the way when it's not working and write something else instead. So, for example, in my first book, which was a novella in flash that came out in 2018, The Crazed Wind, there was one story that just stuck out like a sore thumb because the main character was behaving in a different way. And it was something that I already had written as part of something else, and I tried to fit it in to the collection because it seemed to be on the same theme. But I just thought, it just sounds like somebody else is narrating. And so I got rid of that and then replaced it with something else. But I didn't discard it completely. The original appeared as part of a novel somewhere else.
Ah,
one of the many unpublished novels. I got about six or seven of them.
Yes.
Yeah. So don't waste it. And I do this in my artwork as well. Like, if I've done printmaking and it goes wrong,
I sense a bit of determination.
You just cut it up and you use it in collage. Nothing gets wasted.
Well, good luck with your retirement and your yoga and whatever else you do.
Yeah, thank you, Alan.
We'll be back in a month's time, and I really appreciate your time, Nod. Really do. You've been really good.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yes. And we'll be back in a month's time. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Beyond Rhyme today. Thanks to Scorpio Books for sponsoring this show. Beyond Rhyme brings you conversations with local poets, broadcasting on 96.9 FM on the second Sunday of every month at 3 p.m. If you have enjoyed today's episode, you can listen to our back catalogue on planes.org.nz and Apple Podcast. We hope you make time for poetry and writing in your life.